Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 157, Bliss, Suspicion, and the Three Types of Justice.
And there are a lot of Buddhists, actually, in this country who have heard about voidness or emptiness, as they prefer to call it, most of the people. And they are thinking that that emptiness is just an ancient version of their nothingness. And even in some of the Buddhist languages in certain eras, there was a kind of interchangeable translation of the word nothingness and emptiness in those languages, never in Sanskrit. In the original Indian language and in Tibetan, there's no confusion between emptiness and nothingness. Very, very clear that emptiness actually means universal relativity and is a part of the understanding of that even on a conceptual level, because it's a rational conceptual concept. It's like this concept of zero. Actually, maybe some of you don't know that. You know the decimal system and the concept of zero. Do you know where that originated on this planet in the recent few millennia? Does anybody know? Actually, in some science dictionaries or math dictionaries or history of math, you'll still see today, some people think they got it from the Arabs. But actually, the Arabs got it in India. So the decimal system was first invented, at least in our current knowledge, in India. And they were tired. They didn't want to do like the poor Romans going XVIIIMMMCCCC and never stopping, hammering on bronze or brass or stone, carving some year. And so they had a decimal system, They figured that out. And the word for zero in the decimal system is shunya in Sanskrit, which is the word for emptiness or voidness, as I prefer to call it. That's the same word. So what emptiness means is like zero, But what zero is the place where all kinds of things take place, if you follow me. It's not nothing, right? Zero. Not at all. It's the room for infinite numbers, So therefore, the zero-ness of intrinsic, of non-relational essential realities in all relative realities, that zero-ness is emptiness relativity equivalence, which is the essence of what's called non-duality in Buddhism. And what that means, might be a shock to some of you who have encountered perhaps what we call in the sort of philosophical levels of Buddhism, dualistic Buddhism. That is a kind of Buddhism, Theravada is the main one nowadays. There used to be 18 different schools in India. But they teach that nirvana is somewhere else from this world. It's a release world. And they're a little unclear about exactly what sort of world it is, actually. they said, well, Buddha didn't really say, et cetera. But actually, he did actually say. He quite clearly did say. But that's another story. I can discuss that if someone has a question about that. They say he didn't say, but actually he did say here and there, implicitly, And you might have heard that, because the reason Buddha allowed certain groups of his followers to think that, which I think were particularly male Brahmins, most of his early ascetical monastic or mendicant disciples were Brahmins or Kshatriyas, upper caste, and mostly males. Although at one point a lot of nuns did arrive when he opened the door to them, but most of them were. And he allowed them to think in terms of that dualism because he felt, I think rightly, that it's too hard to imagine. If you're a sensitive person and you're a seeker and you're seeking freedom from suffering, you think there might be such a thing. You sort of heard about it in your culture, oneness with God, for the Indian theists of the time, or nirvana for the people who were following Buddha, it's inconceivable to you that this same world here could be nirvana if you understood its reality. Because to them, they think their world of bumps and pains and bruises and injuries and slights and death and sickness and old age and birth and etc., all the difficulties of life, they think that that's really totally suffering. So a place, an experience, a being beyond that suffering would have to be elsewhere, sort of like a super heaven or something. You know, it's natural they would think that. So Buddha let them think that, actually. But then he warned them. He said that, and he said there are these four formless realms or four non-material realms that you can reach in meditation. And those are realms of infinite space, a realm of infinite, more subtle than that, above that or not above, because there's no spatiality, sense of spatiality in those realms. There's a sort of inner withdrawal concentration realm. So infinite space is like where everything dissolves into and you feel like there's nothing around you, but you are conscious of space. Then your consciousness explodes out into that, and that's called infinite consciousness, which is a more subtle state, where you sort of feel you are aware, you are an infinite awareness. And then of still this spaciousness, there's no objects or differentiations in it, including you and the subject and object. You're just in this space. And then beyond, then absolute nothingness, the experience of the state of absolute nothingness, but which obviously isn't nothingness because it's a state you're experiencing it, but it's what you expect nothingness to be, the picture you have of it, which is a dark space. And you're like unconscious in it, more or less. And then a state beyond consciousness and unconsciousness, or neither conscious nor unconscious, which then is the super subtle most state, which you can possibly imagine of sort of complete withdrawal, you know, coming away from our normal sense spheres, you know, subjects and objects, visual and audio and whatever. And he said all four of those states, which are four, you could say, extreme possibilities of a state that seemed to be a real state to someone who's in it, that is apart from the differentiated world. And he clearly stated none of them are nirvana. Not a single one of them is a state of release. And if you don't know that and you get seduced by entering one and thinking you'll stay there forever and you don't even want to go back, almost like you died and went into the state and you don't want to go back to a body that's stuck in India and has to eat chapatis and beg for lunch or whatever, or be a layperson and worry about your household or whatever. If you don't want to, then you become a deity of that formless realm or immaterial realm for extremely long period of time relative to earth time. And then, but because what goes up must go down, what dissolves, you know, recoalesces after this inconceivably long period of time, which frustratingly is experienced as no time at all, because there's no differentiation. I don't know if you've ever had full anesthesia in some medical situation, but you have it every night when you fall asleep, right? You go sound asleep, and then ding, time to get up in the morning, right? You don't have, unless you have dreams or you're wakeful and you wake up a couple of times or something, you don't really have a sense of time passing when you're unconscious. Right, you just slip in and you're almost gone, and then you got to get up again and go through the day, right? And that's apparently those experiences are ultimate version of that. But then the world you wake up back in, you don't know what it's going to be because of all this incredible complexity of psychophysical biology, not just material biology, but psychophysical biology, which Buddha taught long before Darwin. So anyway, that's the so he taught that. But actually emptiness means that this relativity is ultimate reality. All this what we're doing right now, we never have left ultimate reality. We're in nirvana now, therefore theoretically speaking, because nirvana can't ever begin. Because it's not a created state. It's uncreated, it's always been here. We've always been in it. But we haven't known that, that's the thing. So if we knew the reality of this, without destroying this, our experience here would be nirvana. So that's unimaginable to people who are very sensitive and afraid of pain and afraid of the struggle of self versus other and all this. They can't imagine having an experience of oneness. You know, I always harp about this. Some of you, you probably heard me too many times do this, I apologize, but some of you are a little bit new and didn't read. I always harp on this, that people in many mystical traditions think that the ultimate reality and the ultimate experience is some sort of disappearance from this world, like heavenly sort of thing, or super heaven, or something like that. And so, and if you learn to be a meditator, or you become a mystic or something, you can have experiences of kind of as if you were obliterated in a positive way, like you just weren't there, and you gave it all up, you gave it up. You can have such an experience. And so, therefore, you know, you may have heard, I don't know, some of you may have even heard someone who had a supernormal experience. I never say supernatural, but supernormal experience, where, you know, they just felt the universe was a vast space, and they were that one vast space themselves. So the whole thing, all the problem was solved because it's all one, and it was just vast space and openness, no problems. Of course, no one there either, neither them nor the other people. So in a way, they had withdrawn, I'm sorry to say psychotically, from the interconnectedness with other beings. And from their own relative continuum of being, they felt, they had a subjective experience of thus being withdrawn. But that can't be absolute reality. Because there's a boundary between your state of continuum as a relational being, obviously relational being, and then you enter a state where it seems like you are everything, but there's nothing there. Those two are different states, so there was a boundary. So therefore, that's a relational state, even though it's a relational state that seems like your picture of what the absolute should have been. Do you follow me? Now, that doesn't mean that that isn't a very important experience. You know, in the Heart Sutra, which we chanted, and after talking about matter is voidness, voidness is matter, which is right away preempting, you could say, or precluding an idea that matter is one thing, that's the samsara world of suffering, you know, the solid world, and then there's this voidness that is like nirvana, it's like a transcendent place. So it says, no, they are the same thing, he says right away. But then once he says that, he then says, no, no eye, no ear, no matter, no voidness, no sensation, no consciousness, no, 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 no. He goes, no, 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 a lot of no, no, no's. You know, meaning that he's stressing the one side of a non-dualistic, dualism-tolerating vision. Do you follow me? Why do I say non-dualistic? Because that means that the enlightened condition, like the condition of a Buddha, is to be aware of oneness with everyone, but it's not what I just talked about before, what I call the cheap oneness, the easy oneness, where you just obliterate yourself in some way. The expensive oneness is where you're all one with everything, and everybody is there. And therefore, you're one with them all, even the pain in the neck ones, like some that we all have on our minds, morning, noon, and night, just turn on CNN. or NBC or whatever, you know. We're one with them. We're all one with, so we're all one with all of them. So what that means is that one's awareness can be alert to differentiation, but at the same time does not depart from the sense of it all being one thing. It's sort of like, and don't say it's impossible to have such an ambiguity tolerating, or as I said, dissonance tolerating, or dualism tolerating non-dual mind or awareness, because you do that yourself all the time. Whenever you look in a mirror, you're looking in a mirror and you're seeing a room in the mirror like it would be a window you could reach into. But you learn that at one point that that's not the case. It's not a mirror. It's not a window into a room. It's not a three-dimensional thing, it's just a projection on a flat surface, a reflection on a flat surface. And it's actually yourself in there, looking left, right, reversed, and a room behind you when you look in a mirror. And then you look again at that mirror and you sort of know that it's the blank mirror surface. You know, showing the room behind you as one surface. It's not two surfaces. You know that. You don't rethink, of course. You don't have to remind yourself, except maybe occasionally, if you find yourself shaving the wrong side or something. You know, left side, right side. You know, you don't have to remind yourself. You sort of know them simultaneously. And of course, that's not nearly like a complete knowledge where a Buddha, an enlightened being, or Avalokiteshvara, is looking at people and faces and things like that, and he's sort of both seeing them and seeing through them. Or it'd be like if you had an experience that you were sitting in a room full of people, and for some reason suddenly the whole room and yourself and the wall, everything seemed as if it was made of crystal or glass. So you could still see them like outlines and reflecting in different ways, but in a way you could also see through them. So you could see the person behind the person by seeing through them and then sort of focusing your field of depth of the person behind, you know. If you could imagine a situation like that, you're both seeing through and yet you can pick out one particular thing within your field of vision and focus on that, even though that person is transparent. You follow? So it's a sort of situation like that. These are just analogies for something we can't conceive of quite. But it's, I always like to say, it's like we have some habitual assumption that enlightened state must be some very simple thing, some easy and simple thing, and nothing like our complicated state. The idea that the enlightened condition or state or continuum of enlightened mind or being or whatever is something more dissonance-tolerating, more complex, more subtle than our normal consciousness is something we don't easily do. So anyway, that's the thing. Anyway, I don't want to go back into the whole wisdom thing. I did say some of you, I think, are like a little bit new to the game. Because today we're going to do generosity. We're going to do generosity. Justice, which is my innovative translation for people called Shila is the Sanskrit word, and they call it discipline, morality, ethics. Those three things are there. Usually morality in the old days. Some people nowadays discipline. In this translation, he uses the word discipline for the second transcendence. There are six transcendences. You know, I have it here. There are six transcendences which are put together here in this introduction of the generosity chapter, where I said, sort of show how they fit together. Where is that? Oh, I didn't mark that page. It doesn't matter. You know, there's what's that?
Is that paramitas or is that?
Which one?
Are the transcendences the same as the six paramitas?
The six transcendences, yeah.
Is that what it is?
But other people call them the perfections, or some. These translators are weakening, and they now and then throw in a little transcendent perfection. I'm pushing transcendence thing, and that's a philological story. I don't want to waste to spend time on. But the Sanskrit word is paramita, which means having gone beyond. So the idea of transcending something is very much in them. It's not just perfection means sort of capturing something, and it's perfect. But these are not perfections, they're transcendences. Because when you have perfect generosity, it means that you're transcendent to the idea of property, of giving and receiving, and therefore you're completely unattached to anything. So in a way, you've given away the whole universe to all other beings. That's an enlightened state, transcendent generosity. You don't perceive yourself as owning anything, in other words. And so you're automatically, if anybody wants anything, you're already given. It's already given, type of thing. You know. And the great thing about the infinite lifestyle, just because it uses this term, so I just wanted to see it, is that you discover you have endless resources for sharing. You might still like some things you possess some of the time, but finally, over the course of a life, and certainly at death, your world, your environment, your country, your gender, your race, your nation, your town, your ball club, your house and garden, your apartment, your furniture, your jewels, your money, your clothes, your shoes, your books, your name, your friends, your relations, your family, your body, your speech, your mind, your memory, identity, command of thought, all are gone. So we are already going to be giving everything away. You know, we all know that not a single one of these things is us. The sum total of all of them together even is not us. They are conventionally ours for a time, then they are no longer ours. So therefore, they are not ultimately ours. Everything changes. Anything acquired is eventually lost. All that is lost is eventually regained. Everything and everyone also come back. When you become enlightened and you're all one with it, all of the things you gave away. So the terminal lifestyle is constantly plagued by the fear of death. Since you fear that when you die and lose everything, it is forever gone. Though your regret might be muted temporarily by the assumption that you will not be there to miss it. Or the hope, like my grandfather was like that. The infinite lifestyle, but after 2 years of discussion with me, he got into the away from the terminal lifestyle. At 92, from 92 to 94. By 93, 94, he was totally into the infinite lifestyle. It was more pleasant than he'd been in decades. The infinite lifestyle lets you hold on to things more lightly, to people, even your own body, mind. Your soul, your relative changing conventional subtle mind, your super subtle continuum, is more important since it goes with you from life to life. It changes for good or ill all the time according to your acts and thoughts. During the between state after your death, the soul gravitates to your next life form, driven by the instincts you have cultivated in this life. Your instincts are themselves shaped by your positive or negative acts of body, speech, and mind. In Buddhism, the soul, quote unquote, is sometimes called the spiritual gene or gotra, since its encoded patterns guide your mental and physical processes as they elaborate new living forms. So I thought that was just fun. Anyway, so in the way I've treated each of these, three transcendences, which are said to be the three altruistic transcendences. In other words, they deal with other beings. You can't do generosity without recipients of your generosity to get started with other beings, in other words. You can't cultivate what I prefer to call justice in its ancient sense of being a sort of sense of the appropriateness and the rightness of things, and that no one should be harmed inappropriately, things should be always in their right place, like more like what we might, I coined a term in there of justness, just so, just the right way, you know, unharmful to others, you know, justness, you know, like there's an ideal way that everyone can relate in a certain, there's an ideal win-win in every situation. And if you find that, that's the just situation, the idea. As I say in there, you know, justice, we wrongly think of justice as punishment, you know, as the cop says. Judge Dredd or something like that. They have comic books like that as dealing vengeance, you know, justice. But that's really not justice. And I mentioned there something I saw on TV where one miner in West Virginia was very unhappy about some cops breaking up a strike of some really bad conditions in a mine and all this, some of these horrible coal mines. And the guy said to the TV guy, you know, the TV reporter said, they were saying something about the law and your legal right. And he said, oh, he said, we got plenty of law around here. We just ain't got no justice. He said, some minor. So everyone knows there's a difference, you know, between sort of punishment and enforcing rules and so forth, the rules of the oligarchy, rather than what is just appropriate and correct to be unharmful to the maximum people, you know, sort of the essence of ethic, you know, morality being. Actually, in the... of those, and then the third one is patience. So they sort of fit every option, you see. Generosity is you acting benevolently to all others, right? Patience is you not reacting harmfully to receiving harm, to someone harming you, to injury of some sort. So you don't get angry and want vengeance or whatever, you know, reparation from those people. I don't want them to pay. Because you're using the injury and the adversity in a higher level. So those are the three other concerned transcendences. And then the self-fulfilling, those are the other fulfilling, you could say, transcendences. Your altruism fulfilling transcendences. But your self-fulfilling, you can't really go around fulfilling others, helping others effectively, if you're not fulfilling and helping yourself. Because you yourself have to have compassion for yourself, right? So the two of this first six transcendences, the two transcendences that are self-fulfilling are the contemplation one, the meditation one, the fifth one, and the wisdom one, most of all. Because you're most, you will be self-satisfied. You really will when you really understand yourself and the world. That's when you will be completely self-satisfied, actually. And only when you're completely self-satisfied, to such a degree that you never could have expected, will you feel so full of joy and bliss and relief that it will automatically resonate toward others. And you, it will seem to you that they should have such satisfaction. And actually, even you will see them as having such satisfaction. You will see that satisfaction kind of in their bones, in their cells and everything. But you realize that their mind is immensely unsatisfied. And their mind is completely convinced that it's really a hard situation. It's a long, hard, it's a hard rain going to fall, like Patti Smith sang the other night. It's a hard rain.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast was originally live streamed as a part of the Force for Good class series now happening at Tibet House US in New York City. To learn more about this ongoing series, please visit tibethouse.us. This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To listen to the original recording, please visit the Tibet House US member archives located at tibethouse.us. Now back to Bob in the second half of this week's podcast.
Compassion only really is genuine when the compassion, the person who has the compassion himself or herself or itself has happiness. Because compassion is not tolerating the other's suffering, or compassion for yourself is not tolerating your own suffering, seeing it as futile and wishing to get rid of it. That's compassion for yourself. We don't even think of that as anything unusual because we just want to avoid pain automatically. But an enlightened person, they automatically want to avoid everybody's pain. That's the new thing. But they can do that because they see them all as pain-free. They themselves are completely pain-free. They see the mirror surface is filled with bliss, void, indivisible, as they say. Buddha was careful not to say that to some beginning students. Bliss, void, bliss, freedom, bliss, nirvana. Nirvana, samsara, indivisible. He didn't say that because if he'd called nirvana bliss rather than just cessation of suffering, the minimalist thing you can call it, if he'd called it bliss, they would have suspected him. Because everybody, even ancient India, even today, everybody's really suspicious of bliss. Totally. You know, we're Americans, we live in New York, we're supposed to be having a happy time in New York, going to jazz clubs and whatever. But actually, everyone's scared of bliss, you know. Just think about it. Your roommate, your friend, your mate, your child, your parent comes home one day. I'm so blissed out, I couldn't even begin to think about what and why. Well, why? What happened? You immediately feel worried, right? Are they starting, are they going megalomaniac? Are they going to have a depressed crash and commit suicide? Like, what's wrong with them? You say, what happened? What happened to you? And you smell their breath, right? You, like, check them out. Are they drugged? Are they drunk? Whatever. And you keep investigating. And if they do convince you that it's nothing too extraordinary, then, of course, you're, like, jealous, right? Like, how could you do that? I wasn't there. Like, whatever, you know. What about me? Right? So we're very, as I used to say, I think actually bliss is more or less illegal in more or less most cultures. For example, nobody knows this, but you know Mao Zedong's blue pajama routine, where the entire country had to run around for like 4 decades in blue pajamas, and nobody could have a gold earring or anything, that would be bourgeois or something, and of course the government won't hold the gold. There was any. But that wasn't invented by the communists. Back in the old days, you know, nobody could wear red except in some royal courtesan house, geisha house or something, or some, you know, queen or someone in the harem. And yellow could only be on the roof of such and such a level, the royal thing, the imperial thing. And then, you know, the colors, the ancient Chinese word for libido, for sensuality, is the word for color. So it was already, that Chinese were already into that, yeah, long before Mao. He was just following the imperial habit. So anyway, but today we're doing all three of these all together, you know. So the way I broke down Shantideva's thing on generosity, he doesn't do much on generosity, actually. He has a verse, you know, and he wants to make sure that we know that generosity, they are translating, I notice in this one, giving. But in a way, that's not really good, because Shantideva rightly says, he said, if giving was actually giving, he said that everybody in the universe would be infinitely wealthy, because enlightened beings are numberless and they always want to give everything away. Actually, it's just generosity, the willingness to give whatever it is. It isn't. That's what generosity really is. It's being detached from it all. Whether or not you give it, once you're detached from it all, is a matter of what does it benefit the recipient? It's a little more complex than just giving, you know. So it's not a good translation to translate dana. The Sanskrit word is dana. Like, it's the same root as our word donation, dana. Dana is the generosity and the willingness to give, you know. It's the openness to give. And then there are even practices like where something which are, you know, there's a ritual actually where they, which I mentioned here, you know, where in meditation, this is the last of this meditation we're going to do, but there's a ritual where, you know, we worry a lot about the world, we worry about the planet, we worry about the climate deniers and the oil industries worldwide, like now trashing us even more, and undoing the one feeble attempt at Paris Accords, etc. And we worry about wars, and we worry about all kinds of people in trauma, or maybe terrorists coming and putting us in trauma. We do have a lot of this kind of worry about the state of the world. And so there's a thing where we think, well, my world, this is my world. And we visualize, they did something different in ancient time. They visualized an axial mountain and so forth. So I think for our modern people, we visualize that, like we are a giant from outer space or something, and we pick up the planet Earth in our two hands like this, like without disturbing it somehow. We just do it magically or meditationally. And then we appreciate what a beautiful jewel-like planet it is and how much we love living here when it's springtime or it's warm weather or we're at the beach on vacation in a beautiful mountain vista or whatever. And we think, okay, you know, we unenlightened people are not taking very good care of it. So I give it away to you all enlightened beings to please take care of. And so you have the idea of giving away the planet. And you rehearse doing that, you could say. Just giving your planet away. You just think about that. Idam guru ratna mandala kam niryatayami. There's a sort of ancient hallowed verse. I discuss it in the book. You know, that you say, I give this to the teacher, meaning to the enlightened teachers of Buddha and so on, and his successors, all the many Buddhas. So that's generosity. And then I discuss, in each one of these transcendences or transcendent virtues or transcendences, I have a preamble, I have the problem, which is the opposite of generosity, which is dissatisfaction and stinginess. And I talk about how we're afflicted by that and how fruitless it is and futile to hang on to it. And then the practice of reaching out, and then the personal performance and society. In each section I have practice and performance. Because I get tired of people practicing all the time, and myself included, and I want to try to perform in actual life, you know, whatever it is that one might have attained. So, okay, so that's generosity. So now the second thing is justice. And as I said, Shantideva says very little about generosity. He has only one verse about it, which I didn't really mark, but he really gets into justice. And the reason is that the reason he does so much do that is that human beings get to be human by justice, by being ethical. That is to say, when we were tigers and lions and scorpions and whatever other kind of creature we once were, when we were every other kind of creature in the Buddhist view, Buddhist biology, we were that one who somehow, which is very difficult as an animal, we hadn't read Dr. Spock or Freud or whatever, you know, and there is no such thing. But, you know, when we were about to attack the wildebeests, say we're lions on the veldt in Africa, lioness, actually, because lion, male lions too lazy to hunt, but a lioness. And we were about to attack a herd of them, and then there was a pregnant wildebeest mom galloping along with some difficulty because she was quite pregnant. And then there was some old and broken down wildebeest. And if we were the type of lioness who saw the kind of bloated midriff pregnant mom who thought that would be even more tasty too for the price of one young and tender and pounced on her, we would sort of not really rise above the tiger mold because we'd just be eating whatever was in front of us without any identifying with the victim because it just has to be walking food, you know, so we really can't identify with it. So that's why we think we're absolutely different and that's just an absolute object. That's the animal's vision of the other, right? But some tigress, maybe she just delivered her cubs not long ago, somehow, subliminally, practically, intuits the mother carrying that other new wildebeest, little cute little wildebeest baby. So then kind of knows that the old guy there who's limping along is going to be stringy, old meat, no fat, nothing tender and delicious, but edible. So she then swerves and chomps up the old wildebeest. Now your materialist bio-grammarian, there's a sort of anthropology types who write that kind of thing, they would say, well, it's the species wisdom, she's saving the pregnant one because she wants two to eat later. Give me a break. The only reason she would swerve would be a subliminal empathy, a tiny trace of empathy for the pregnant victim. As similar, both are mammals. Even your predator is a mammal. A mammal is that the females have the young inside their bodies. That's a big experience for any self-centered being. And animals are self-centered like humans. They are more rigidly so. They can't undispel that self-centeredness easily. So it's hard for them to be ethical, in other words, meaning to act in a way where they restrain and guide their action by being empathetic with how it will impinge on others. That's what justice means, right? Or ethics. And so that we got to be human, working our way up from lower forms by being subliminally, instinctively somehow restraining the immediate predator instinct and doing something a little transcendent of that instinct, like diverting it even slightly based on a tiny breakthrough of empathy with another species, you know, the food species, in other words. The suffering of animals, you know, in Buddhism is called chigla chisa, or anyonya bhakshana in Sanskrit, which means eating one another, you know, like our dog-eat-dog idea, you know, eating one another, the misery of one eating another, which is where you are being eaten yourself, you're worried about someone eating you, and you eat what's in front of you, you know, that's the misery of the animal, you know. I really experienced that, actually, watching TV when I was beginning to meditate on Buddhist biology many, many years ago. Hi, Duke, how are you? And are there another chair? There's chairs further in the back. Oh, you got one, good. And I had been meditating this type of thing, you know, about other animals. My teacher sent me to see my mom in this life, my human mom in this life. Here in the city, I was at a monastery in the south, in Bruce Springsteen land, down in the Jersey Flats. And when I was there then in the evening, I was watching my mom's television, and I somehow got stuck on The Living Desert by Walt Disney. And I was into meditating on identifying with other creatures and beings. So I became like hypnotized. It was like an agony in a way, but I became like hypnotized. And I don't know if you've ever seen that, but I'm telling you, one tarantula jumps on one wasp fly, or a wasp fly jumps on a tarantula, and then a snake grabs the wasp fly tarantula, and then somebody else grabs the snake, and it's like you identify with one creature after another, and then chomp. And then you sort of switch to the chomper, and then whap, that one gets chomped. It's an unbelievable succession of people chomping one another. It really freaked me out. Really. Chigla chisa. That is in Tibetan, a very telegraphic type of language. So one eating another. So anyway, okay, that's it. So therefore, it is by ethics that we have become human. And that's the great. And also, if we had been ethical and generous, we go beyond human and we would sort of, especially pushing generosity. Generosity and ethicality also push you toward the God realm, and you sort of overshoot the human realm, head for the God realm, because it's what seems more cozy than the human realm. But somehow we bounce back down or whatever, you know. Because the God thing, then you can't do ethics there in the God thing much. Everybody's having such a good time, there's nobody really much gets hurt in the God realms. But then they don't develop evolutionarily. They don't become enlightened. They just become pleasure-seeking, unfortunately. So anyway, the injustices. I quote this one from the Samadhi Raja Sutra, Royal Meditation Sutra. Things made from causes and conditions are ultimately not made. This is same as saying, if you understand cause and condition, then you understand emptiness. Examining causality, you will know things' freedom or emptiness of intrinsic reality. Or I was trying to make this very more palatable to Westerners, so I said freedom from intrinsic reality. Freedom being a negational word like emptiness, actually. Free, salt-free, sugar-free, trouble-free. It's simply a negation, even though we think of it as a positive concept. It's a negational concept. Understanding freedom, though, the more you understand freedom, the more you are mindful of every little thing. So in other words, the more you understand emptiness, the more committed you are to relativity, and you realize that every thought, even, much less word, much less gesture, has endless impact and endless effect. And so you realize that if a little this way and a little that way, and a little better and more focused and a little more appropriate has a huge meaning. So you become very, very mindful of every kind of action of mind, body, and speech, the three levels of action, most important of which being the mind, actually. And so anyway, that's the same. I already talked about that. And so here there's also three kinds of justice. There's the justice that prevents harm to others and to yourself. There's the justice that wants to do good for others and to yourself. And then there's the kind of justice that wants to fulfill aims. The most transcendent kind is to fulfill beings' aims. And fulfill beings' aims involves the skill of having them, attain liberation, actually, from suffering. That's what they really want, which is attaining happiness, liberation from suffering. That's the real justice, you know, is to whatever it is that wants to get them to do that. And there are a few things I wanted to mention in the justice chapter. It isn't called justice in Shantideva, chapter 5. It's called guarding alertness. And he has a whole start with about mindfulness, you know. Oh, yeah, here at number 10, this is what I was talking about generosity. It says, the perfection of generosity, or the transcendence of generosity, is said to be the thought to give all beings everything, together with the fruits of such a gift. It is indeed a matter of the mind itself. In other words, it isn't the actual act of giving, because you can do physical giving with a very self-centered mind, feeling maybe very regretful you're having to give, feeling very annoyed if someone isn't really appreciative, feeling really self-congratulatory about how great I did some giving. And none of that is transcendent giving. That will not reach to a transcendence or a perfection, you know. And so that's that verse. But it's therefore it's not the giving, it's the generosity. So they should write transcendent generosity. Although you can say someone is a very giving person, I guess you can say. So you can have givingness somehow as a quality of a person that involves an actual gift. But usually giving means giving, you know. Anyway. And he puts in here, he has these three verses, 10, 11, and 12, are the three other concerned transcendences. Then number 11 says, where could beings, fishes, and the rest be placed to keep them safe from being killed? Deciding to refrain from every harmful act is said to be transcendent discipline. He's really going transcendent. Ha, ha, ha. It's great. And they're translating what I'm translating as justice, as discipline, you know, which I don't know about that. But they're yogis, so they want to be disciplined, and that's okay. But discipline also, they didn't read Foucault, you know. Discipline means punishment, you know. Anyway, harmful beings, and the third one is the patience one. Harmful beings are everywhere like space itself. Impossible it is that all should be suppressed. But let this angry mind alone be overthrown, and it's as though all foes have been subdued. That's the patience transcendence right there, or tolerance, whichever you prefer. So he's making the point that all of these things have to do with your mind ultimately, actually. They have to do with your intentional. That is the real driver of Buddhist biology, is the mind. Imagine modern biology saying there is no mind, and it's reductionism. And Buddha's own Darwinian theory about the interrelatedness of all species and the evolution of individuals within species, all entirely is focused down on the subtle level of the mind. And I love this verse, it's a great 13. To cover all the earth with sheets of leather, where could such amounts of skin be found? But it should be hide, come on, where such amounts of hide be found? But with the leather soles of just my shoes, it is though I cover all the earth. So this is a marvelous one about, in a way, this is a critique of Greek and Western materialistic science, actually. You know, starting with the Greeks, you know, and the Democritus and the Adam and the whole thing. In other words, is the job of science to be natural science, meaning to deal with sort of material reality and readjust the material world to suit our human predilections and needs and worries, right? Are we going to change the whole world to fit with our comfort? Or Are we going to change our own ability to find comfort in situations where we can handle different types of situations? Obviously, we don't want, you know, we don't, and then we don't need to destroy the earth. So, in a way, the materialist thing is to cover the earth with leather. And the Buddhist thing is, and the Indian thing, therefore, in general, so much influence that was by Buddha and his tradition and his many, many millions of followers, just fix your mind. Because you know that with your mind, if you're in a really bad mood, you can have like the happiest feast with all your beloved families and best friends and lovers and everything, and have a horrible grumpy time because you feel crappy. And you have something's really freaking you out, like, you know, there's a lunatic in the White House raining on your party. Which could never happen, of course, in a democracy. Whereas when you're really feeling happy, well, there can be any lunatic anywhere, and you're still going to somehow remain cheerful. So that's what determines the quality of your life, is how you understand what's going on. As Mark Epstein always likes to say, it isn't so much what happens to you if it isn't something truly extreme, it's how you react to it, it's how you relate to what happens to you that determines the quality of your existence. You know, that's a big mindfulness thing, you know. And I think it's a good one. And so all those who fail to understand the secret of the mind, the greatest of all things, although they wish for joy and sorrow's end, will wander to no purpose uselessly. Therefore, I will take in hand and will protect this mind of mine. What use to me are many disciplines if I can't guard and discipline my mind? And then he has all these marvelous things. He says, when in wild, unruly crowds, I'm careful and sensitive of my wounds. Likewise, when in evil company, this wound, my mind, I'll constantly protect. You know, like if we didn't have a band-aid, we have an open sore and we're very nervous about it. So the mind is like that. It's easily infectable, he's saying, you know. And my property, my honor, all can freely go. My body and my livelihood as well. And even other virtues may decline. But never will I let my mind regress. So those are some really great ones there at the beginning of the justice one, you know.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. To learn about special upcoming events with Robert Thurman at Menla Retreat and Tibet House, U.S., visit bobthurman.com. Join Robert Thurman in 2018 as he joins Brent Olson in geographic expeditions on his trip to Mongolia. This Dosit trip benefits the work of Tibet House US. For more information, visit bobthurman.com. This is Justin Stone Diaz, the producer of the Bob Thurman Podcast, just saying thanks for tuning in and letting you know your online support is deeply appreciated. Every like, subscription, and listen helps support the ongoing work of Robert Thurman, Tibet House US, and Menla Retreat. Kashi Dalek, and Happy New Year.